only Drake Taylor and Charles Merriman, Orc, were altered physically. Orc died, and we've seen no sign of him, but something about that difference, the physical change, means Drake and Taylor still have their powers outside the PBA. You need to find him, then dig a deep hole and throw him in. Throw a nuke in after him. You don't know what you're dealing with. Actually, we do. That video was taken quite by accident from a military drone on a training run in the Joshua Tree National Park, out in the desert. And when we ran a search, we turned up 18 instances of rape, mutilation, and murder in the area over the last 4 years. It's all being blamed on illegals coming up from the border, of course, the convenient scapegoats. But it was him. People coming across the border don't carry bullwhips. They don't spend hours flaying victims alive, then leaving them to burn in the hot sun. Deka felt her stomach turn, felt her heart pounding, felt fear. Fear like she had not felt in years. You have to warn Astrid. He hates her. Miss Ellison is watched 24 hours a day. We have armed personnel. You don't know what he is, Deka said, her voice rising. You don't know. You do not know. Please, sit down, Peaks urged. Deka sat and swallowed her beer in a single long gulp. Here's the thing, Deka. It's been kept very secret, but pieces of the same space body that created the PBA, the same mutagenic asteroid, are arriving on Earth. The first three pieces, ASO 2, 3, and 4, have already come down. We are doing all we can to retrieve all of that object, but it is entirely possible that some will escape, may even fall into the worst possible hands. We could have more Drakes. We could have a lot of Drakes. Deka, we are looking at the possibility of a world inhabited by dozens or hundreds or thousands of people with extraordinary powers.
What the hell am I supposed to do about it? Deka demanded. I'm a cashier. You're the government.
Peaks looked at her, patient, waiting for her to calm down. Deka saw that he was waiting for her to calm down and really wished she could calm down, but every hair on her body was tingling. Her palms were sweating, and she was nowhere close to calm. Drake. But Deka knew how to look calm. She licked her lips, exhaled a long, slow breath through her barely open mouth, and said, You need to just tell me. All right. Peaks leaned back, satisfied that she was listening. You are an extraordinary person, Deka Talent. Slightly above average IQ, a little hot-tempered, loyal, brave. He made a little admiring snort. Your record is quite clear on that. But the thing that we like best about you is that you are, for lack of a better, more scientific word, strong. Mentally strong, emotionally strong. He smiled and shook his head in sincere appreciation. Some combination of DNA and life experience. You are really quite extraordinary. Thanks, but you told me all that and it's flattering and all, but let's cut the bullshit. Okay? What do you want? Well, it's like this. We have some of the rock, what we're calling the ASO, the anomalous space object. You have direct experience of possessing and using the power the ASO can convey. You are therefore very unlikely to suddenly turn into a Drake. So we want to test it on you. Test what? We want to expose you to the rock. We want to see if these fragments are still capable of causing mutation. We want to see, Deka, whether you can once again acquire powers. Can't be done. Not outside the phase. That's what everyone said. Yes, well, we suspect that everyone is wrong. I have another bit of tape to show you. Did you happen to see anything about the plane accident at LaGuardia? Yeah, the one that broke up on landing? The video I have isn't very good. The person shooting it on their phone was terrified. He tapped his laptop and up came yet another video. It was narrow, with the phone held vertically. At first she could make nothing out, just what looked like airplane seats and wildly gyrating lights and arms and heads. The soundtrack was screams, cries, shouts, loud prayers, terrified humans begging for mercy. Then the picture steadied for just a few seconds and Decca saw a monster, a coral-tinged, huge, hulking creature with what looked like a long blade where the right hand should be and something like a lobster's claw for the left hand. The picture slipped. More wild gesticulations, more screams, and the sound of metal screeching and jet engines suddenly louder. The video stopped. Decca waited. Peek said, "The plane did not simply break up. It was sliced open, opened up on one end by someone armed with a blade capable of cutting through aluminum like a can opener on a can of cat food." "That's no one I ever saw or heard about in the face," Decca said. "No, it's a young art student, believe it or not. We were almost certain that he traveled to Iowa and managed to take what we were calling ASO-3, but we don't believe he was the only one. There are four distinct sets of footprints, though an effort was made to obscure them, so someone else, right here in America, may also have pieces of the meteorite, and that's not even getting into foreign locations." Decca had nothing to say. Her mouth was dry. Her heart felt as if it was trying to pump molasses through her veins. And worse, far worse, is to come. Most of the ASOs are small, like the one that's been stolen, but that we will soon recover. But there's one rock coming. We call it the Mother Rock, which, if it were captured by some enemy force, might be enough to build a massive mutant army. "We need to understand this phenomenon, Decca. We need to know how this happens, how it can be controlled. 61 people died on that flight. Most were burned to death, which is a very bad way to die. We've done the best we can to cover up the cause, spreading all kinds of wild rumors to discredit the truthful accounts, but it's only a matter of time before people see the truth. So you want to test the rock, the ASO rock, on me, see if I develop powers?" Peeks leaned forward, eyes burning behind his spectacles. "In this world, there are very, very few people who can be trusted with that kind of power, Decca. Power corrupts. Power distorts. It can bring out the best in people, but it is much more likely to bring out the worst. If this rock, this ASO, can create that..." He pointed at the freeze frame of the bladed monster. "We could be on the verge of a massive change that would upset every institution of government, business, society in general. Drake, Taylor, this art student. It is our duty to stop these people. You want me to turn into that? No thanks." "Ah, but our young art student was able to revert, to turn back into himself. It seems as if the power and the morph are inextricably linked. This makes it worse, you see, because people with powers can change back, disappear into the population. Decca, they must be stopped." "You stop them," Decca said. "I've had my war." "I know that," Peek said. "We aren't looking for that. We aren't looking for soldiers, Decca. We need to understand the effects of the ASO. We need to test it on you, see whether you, uniquely qualified you, regain your power. And then, Decca..." "Yeah." "Then we need to find a way to take that power away, because only then can society be safe from the Drakes and the Justins." He was very convincing, and Decca knew she had no choice but to help. But at the same time, there was a lie buried in that nice speech. Decca sensed it, but couldn't quite put her finger on it. "All right," Decca said. "You could stick more needles in me." Chapter 8. Daddy Issues. "I want some." They were in Malik's room, the day after the cemetery. Cruz had thought Shade's house was posh, the very symbol of upper-middle-class Evanston, but Malik's home made Shade's look like a shack. His mother was something important at a bank in Chicago, and his father was an author of best-selling mystery novels, a fact that Cruz filed away for future use. A published author might be very helpful someday to an aspiring young writer like herself. Their house fronted Lake Michigan and was filled with abstract art on the walls, an African sculpture resting in lit alcoves or atop marble stands in the spacious formal rooms. Malik's own room was nearly the size of Cruz's entire apartment. Cruz knew there were people who lived like this, but she'd always somehow assumed those were TV people, celebrities, not regular humans. Malik had a small collection of classic electric guitars hanging on one wall, framed posters of Jimi Hendrix, Chuck Berry, Slash, Prince, and various other presumably great guitar players who Cruz did not recognize. They sat, the three of them, Shade in an easy chair, Cruz in a cool hanging swing chair that made her desperately jealous, and Malik on his bed. "Want some what?" Malik asked.
"Rock," Cruz said. "I want some of the rock."
"You know the law of holes, Cruz?"
Malik asked.
"It goes like this. When you're in a hole, stop digging."
"Hmm," Shade said. "And why are you so sure we're in a hole?"
"Really?"
Malik asked with a skeptical tone.
"You think what, you're good? All set?
Shade, you committed a federal crime. You acquired a power. You think the whole government of the United States of America is just going to let that happen? Some girl can turn into some creepy, plasticky, half-flea-looking thing and outrun the speed of sound, and the government is just going to shrug and say, whatever. Have you thought through what this power means, Shade?"
Shade didn't answer, just gave a little hand flourish, an eye roll that meant, "You're going to tell me anyway, so go for it."
"A person with super speed," Malik said, reminding Cruz of Wickedshade, "can go anywhere, steal literally anything, money, secrets. You could zoom into a bank and clean them out. You could go to the Louvre and take the Mona Lisa. You could run into an investment bank, harvest every password. You could do the same at the CIA or the NSA, and not to get too grim about it, but you could run right past the Secret Service and kill the President of the United States. It's better than super strength, or firing energy beams, or telekinesis, or invisibility. It's better than just about anything but teleportation or mind control."
"Teleportation," Cruz mused under her breath. She thought, but did not say. "That would be a cool power for a writer. Observe anyone, anywhere, anytime."
"The government has to stop you, Shade. They have no choice," Malik said.
"Thank God we have the brilliant Malik to tell us the obvious." It was a bit snide, even for Shade, but Malik was used to her.
"You say your house is bugged, which means they suspect you, or at least your dad, so it's only a matter of time," Malik said.
Shade shifted uncomfortably, and looking more defensive than Cruz had ever seen her, said, "It's a fait accompli." Cruz raised her hand like she was in school.
"What is fait accompli?"
"It's French," Shade and Malik said at the same time. "It means accomplished fact, something that's done and can't be undone," Shade said. "Like stealing ASO3. Like eating it. Like becoming..." She waved a hand. "Whatever it is I've become. Fait accompli."
"I helped steal the rock," Cruz said, "so I'm in trouble too. So I think I have a right to, you know."
Shade shared a glance with Malik, who shook his head.
"Don't look at me. I am not interested. So far, I'm just an accessory after the fact, and I am not interested in becoming super anything."
"You already have super condescension," Shade said.
"Yeah, totally unlike you, Shade."
"That YouTube of the plane crash, that creature?" Shade said, almost plaintive. "Come on, we all know it's the ASO. That flight was coming from Iowa. Someone else already got hold of some of the rock."
"Proving what?"
Malik demanded. Then he crinkled his nose.
"This shirt smells. Sorry, I haven't changed since my run."
He rolled off his bed, went to his closet, chose a t-shirt from among about a million, and stripped off his sweat-stained shirt with no sign of modesty. Cruz turned a disbelieving look to Shade as if to say, "You broke up with that? Beautiful, smart, and rich is not good enough for you?" Shade's look was a mix of amusement and perhaps a little regret, an acknowledgement that, yes, Malik was a very fine specimen indeed, a sculpture to rival any in his parents' house, and smart to boot. Cruz silently mouthed, "You are a moron." Shade smiled and gave Cruz the finger in a subtle, underhand way. "Proving," Shade said belatedly,
that there may be more out there, more like him, like me. The government can try to put the toothpaste back in the tube, but I don't think it'll work. Malik sighed. Maybe. Maybe we are on the verge of a total rearranging of life. Maybe Chicago is about to become Gotham, and New York is going to be Metropolis. There are three types of supers, Shade. Hero, villain, and monster. Superman is a hero, and Batman is an anti-hero, which is a subset of hero. Magneto or Lex Luthor are villains. Hulk, and say, the Punisher, are monsters. People dangerously out of control. Yeah, and who stands up to Magneto? Shade demanded. Heroes, that's who. This character who killed the people on that plane is a bad guy. There will be others. Who stops them? The government, if they aren't busy chasing you, Malik said, exasperated. Why are you doing this, Shade? Shade stood up suddenly, nervous energy getting the better of her. And what if the government becomes the villain? Malik leaned back and frowned. Shade, sensing an opening, paced back and forth, glancing now at Malik, now at Cruz, like a TV lawyer making her case to the jury. You don't think the government is going to use the Rock for their own purposes? You don't think someone at the Pentagon is thinking, oh cool, super soldiers, super cops, super spies? Malik's silence was acknowledgement, but he rallied. Now you're like a gun nut arguing we need guns to overthrow the government. Shade shook her head, thinking out loud on a roll, looking at the floor. This is the same government that set off a nuke next to the dome, the PBA, because it was blocking the highway. I'm not saying they're evil, just saying that the temptation is there, and the temptation is there partly because they need to find ways to stop people like you, Malik insisted. Shade talked right over him. I guarantee you they're looking for ways to use the ASOs. So are other governments. The ASO is one big unpredictable weapon. We're going to have government supers and individuals like the plane guy. The world is changing, Malik. I didn't make it happen. I'm just saying, since it is happening, I don't want to be standing there doing nothing while... She stopped suddenly, knowing she'd said too much. She switched gears. What if there had been no Sam Temple or Dekka or Brianna to fight back against Kane and Drake and Penny? Not to mention that... The creature. Gaia, Shade demanded. Cruz did not immediately recognize the names, but she understood what Shade meant. What if only the bad people had powers? Shade grabbed her phone and tapped something in, waited, then read aloud. Things fall apart. The center cannot hold. Mere anarchy is loosed upon the world. The blood-dimmed tide is loosed, and everywhere the ceremony of innocence is drowned. The best lack all conviction, while the worst are full of passionate intensity. Malik groaned. Yeah, I know the poem. We read it in AP English Comp. Cruz again raised her hand, still feeling like she was in school. I don't. Shade handed her her phone. The best lack all conviction, Shade said to Malik. It's the worst who are full of passionate intensity. Cruz read aloud the final lines. And what rough beast, its hour come round at last, slouches toward Bethlehem to be born. Well, that's cheerful, Cruz said. I saw one rough beast, Shade said. Its name was Gaia. Now we've seen another. More are coming. The center isn't holding. Maybe I'm not the best, but I'm not the worst either. Malik's stony expression softened. Of course you're not, babe. You're totally obsessed, a bit ruthless, and God knows you're manipulative. But you're also decent and basically kind. If you weren't, I wouldn't... They exchanged a look full of history, a look Cruz envied. Shade and Malik might not be dating, might argue constantly when they were together, but the first time Cruz saw Malik, she had known he was still in love with Shade. And if Shade didn't quite mirror that emotion, she was, at the very least, fond of Malik. I am what I am, Shade said to him. There's no way to change what's happened. Anyway, we were talking about Cruz. She pulled a baggie from her purse and held it up. It contained a small amount of gray powder. I ground some more. You're like a drug dealer offering free samples, Malik said, but Cruz saw that his eyes followed the baggie with glittering interest. Cruz was there with me in Iowa, Shade said. She has a right, if that's what she wants.
I don't really want powers, Cruz said. I just want... you know what I want.
The last part came out in a low, embarrassed mutter. We both had bad luck in life, Cruz. Me the day the dome came down. You with, well, parents who don't appreciate God's little joke.
They have an operation that can solve that problem, Malik said. I get that it's expensive. My parents won't consent.
Cruz said bitterly. Even if I suddenly had the money, it's a whole long process, not just some quick operation. And that's if I even get to the point of being sure, which would be way easier if the whole world wasn't yelling at me. Ugh!
Cruz is somewhat conflicted, Shade said dryly. Multiple choice in a true-false world.
You wouldn't understand.
Of course I understand, Malik snapped. It's an obvious metaphor.
There you go, Cruz. Now you see the condescending Malik. He always has to think he's the smartest person in the room.
Right, unlike you, Cruz said, but she whispered it.
Malik shook his head, but he was already accepting defeat.
Whatever. You've got your shovel and I know you, Shade. You'll keep digging.
Might dig straight through to China, Shade said, trying to lighten the mood.
The antipode of Chicago is not China. It's the Indian Ocean, about 2,500 miles south of Sri Lanka.
Malik, naturally, to which Shade responded with a little flourish of ta-da hands, inviting Cruz to witness Malik's obnoxiousness.
Cruz ignored Shade and contemplated Malik, who sadly was now wearing a shirt. She'd been describing herself as gender fluid, and she was most comfortable with female pronouns, but she had resisted defining herself as the cliched girl trapped in a boy's body. How much of that was her own reluctance to commit, to define herself, and maybe to suffer the consequences?
Was Malik right? Or was Shade? Or was this Cruz looking for another multiple choice in a binary world?
Cruz? Shade asked, sounding concerned. But Cruz did not answer. Cruz sat looking at the baggie, looking at the dust that might give her power after a life of powerlessness.
What if it makes me a monster?
It won't, she told herself. There was no monster inside her just itching to get out. She would never hurt anyone.
Got any peanut butter? Cruz asked abruptly.
That's how Shade took it.
You two are crazy, Malik said. Then, with a sigh, is Chunky okay? My little sister likes Chunky, so we get Chunky.
After a while, Shade and Cruz left, Shade having a gynecologist's appointment, and Cruz now having decided to actually finish the paper she had so studiously avoided writing. She walked to the city library and studied there, eyes swimming with boredom, mind not even slightly engaged with the books before her.
Is it working?
Finally, reluctantly, she headed home, performing the ritual of defeminization as she went, torn between relief and resentment that the rock had apparently done nothing to her. It had long bothered her, this need to disguise herself, to try to minimize the triggers that would set her father off. But now it was more than annoying, it was infuriating. Shade accepted her, Malik accepted her. Much of the world, not all, but much of it, accepted her. Why couldn't her parents accept her? She was still the person she'd always been, the exact same child they loved. Why did it matter so much? Why did people get angry at her for the crime of dressing and acting and talking the way she wished? And like a taunt of her own devising, a voice in her head repeated, like a refrain. Shade would never be afraid. She was halfway up the stairwell to her apartment, the stairwell reeking of pumpkin spice since the seasonal latte was back at Starbucks, when she realized she'd been stomping rather than creeping up the stairs. Cruz slowed her pace, tried to slow her breathing, pushed down on the anger that wanted so badly to explode. She opened the door. Normal sounds, the TV, the dishwasher. She crept in, practically tiptoeing now, feeling the flicker of a simple hope that she could reach her bedroom without hassle. But there was her father, coming straight toward her, heading for the bathroom. He did not speak, just looked at her. Cruz stepped aside.
She was hungry and wondered if this was a good opportunity to grab a snack to take to her room. The kitchen was empty, and she was just about to snag a box of Wheat Thins when her mother came in. Her mother, too, did not look at her. In fact, it was as if Maria Rojas hadn't noticed her 6'2" child at all. Cruz shrugged. If that's the game they wanted to play, fine. She opened the door, looking for cream cheese, and her mother yelped, "Ah!" Maria was staring at the refrigerator, frowning, her face suspicious and wary. Maria pushed the refrigerator door shut and turned away, muttering in Spanish. Cruz opened the refrigerator door again, and this time Maria screamed. Manny Rojas came at a run, 3 feet of toilet paper stuck to his shoe. "What?" he demanded.
"The door," Maria said in a gulping panic. "It opened all by itself."
"What the hell are you talking about, woman?"
Something electric was climbing up Cruz's spine. No, impossible. She had left the box of Wheat Thins on the counter. She lifted it, making a rustling noise that instantly drew her parents' attention.
"What was that?"
Manny, Cruz's father, this time. Cruz, feeling as if she was in a dream, held the Wheat Thins directly in her father's line of sight. Nothing. No reaction. Cruz waved her free hand before his face, peering intently at his eyes. Not a flicker, not a movement of his iris. "He can't see me." What had been a tingle was now a rush, a thrill that raised goosebumps on Cruz's arm. She could see the bumps. She could see her arm. She could see the Wheat Thins. She could see everything. And they did not see her, or anything she held. She set the box on the counter and stepped back.
"Wheat Thins!"
her mother shrieked.
"Look, Mommy, look!"
"Okay, Wheat Thins, so what?" he demanded, getting angry at all the strangeness.
"They were no there, and then they there."
"You're crazy, woman. Have you been drinking?"
But he looked around himself, suspicious, worried. Cruz retreated to the hallway, retreated all the way to the front door. She leaned back against the wall, trying not to gulp air, trying to control the hammering in her chest. "I'm invisible." Bugs or no bugs, she had to see shade like right now. She bolted, clattering down the stairs, stopped on the street outside, wanting further proof. There was a ponytailed mom leaning over her baby in a stroller. Cruz put her hand directly between mother and child and... nothing. Oh my God. She ran toward Shade's house just a block away, but as she ran, she had the unsettling sensation of being observed. She glanced around. No one. She peered at the nearest windows. No one was staring at her. But still she felt it, the feeling of being watched, and more than just watched. There was a feeling of malice, a feeling that someone was not only watching her, but secretly laughing at her. She shook it off, knocked on Shade's door, and when it opened, pulled Shade out onto the rear deck and whispered, "Can you see me? I haven't gone blind, Cruz."
"I was invisible. I guess I stopped being, but I was absolutely invisible."
"Are we talking metaphorically?"
Cruz shook her head. Then she focused the swirl of wild emotion inside her and,
"Whoa," Shade said. "You can't see me now, can you? Okay, that is amazing. Get inside now before someone sees or doesn't see you."
They moved immediately to Shade's bathroom and turned on the water for the benefit of any microphones. Cruz flickered back into view.
"How did it feel?"
Shade asked, and Cruz knew there was something specific behind that bland question.
"Fine, normal," Cruz said. Except, I had this feeling, probably just paranoid.
Shade drew breath and exhaled slowly.
"Like something was watching you?"
Cruz nodded slowly. "Something you can't see, something you can only feel, something dark and well, not necessarily nice."
"Yes,"
Cruz said. It came out in a low hiss.
"Right,"
Shade said, as if she was ticking off a checklist. She shook her head, silently arguing with herself. "It's probably just paranoia caused by the weirdness of the morph." Cruz was willing to accept that, wanted to accept it. It made logical sense, but did it feel true?
No.
But Cruz told herself she'd worry about that another time, because really, what was exploding inside her mind was the fact that she had the power of invisibility.
"Let's go somewhere and test this out," Shade said. Come on, I have to tell my dad we're going out. He's home, so wipe the insane grin off your face.
They headed downstairs and into the living room to say a quick polite hello to Martin Darby. And that was when the front-facing windows of the house lit up in flashing blue and red.
Chapter 9. On the Run. Blue and red lights flashed against the curtains and the frosted glass of the front door, and instantly Shade knew. She knew what this was, knew what it meant, and knew that a huge gaping pit had opened up beneath her. Her stomach churned, her jaw clenched, her heart beat heavy and slow. There was the sound of people knocking on a door, and then there was the sound of police knocking on a door. The one said, "Are you home?" The other said, "Open the door, now!" Shade and Cruz rushed to the door and arrived in time to see Martin Darby turn the doorknob. He opened the door and all hell broke loose. "Back, back, back away! You against the wall!" Half a dozen men in helmets and black tactical gear, each armed with an automatic weapon, rushed in. One threw Shade's father to the ground, and another shoved the muzzle of his gun in Cruz's face and backed her against the wall, then roughly grabbed Shade's shoulder and slung her beside Cruz. There was a great deal of yelling. "Do not move! Who else is in the house?" A bespectacled man, who looked like he should be working at the DMV, squatted beside Martin and shoved a piece of paper in his face. "Homeland Security, we are serving a search warrant." "What the hell?" Martin yelled into his own oriental rug. Through the open door, Shade saw a veritable Christmas tree of police lights, a big black SWAT van, black SUVs, regular Evanston cops, even an ambulance. More men and women poured into the house. They were in white coveralls, crime scene people, technicians. Shade sent Cruz a significant look. Yes, this is about The Rock. And yes, professional searchers would absolutely find it in the heat register where Shade had stashed it. "Get him up," the bespectacled man said, indicating Professor Darby. Two SWAT guys grabbed Martin's arms and stood him up, keeping their hands on him like he was some kind of criminal. Anger and guilt competed within Shade's mind. There was something simply infuriating in seeing her father treated this way. "My fault."
"My name is Tom Peaks. I'm with Homeland Security and DARPA. Let's get right to it, Professor Darby. Turn over The Rock. Do it now, do it painlessly, and maybe we can..."
"What the hell are you talking about?"
Martin tried to shake off the SWAT guys, but it was like trying to shake off a pair of pit bulls.
"Professor, this can be easy and quickly over, or it can be traumatic as we tear your house apart."
Peaks said, "I just flew in from the West Coast and I'm tired, so let's go down the easy path. What do you say?"
"What I say is I don't have the first clue where the ASO is. As I've been telling my direct supervisor at the task force, Dr. Red Eagle..."
"Yes,
I know what you've been telling HSTF-66. I read all the reports. I run HSTF-66, Professor Darby, and whether you know it or not, you work for me."
Peaks let that sink in, then motioned to the SWAT guys to release their grip on Martin. Martin climbed to his feet.
"Leave my daughter and her friend alone,"
he demanded with all his professional authority.
"No one is bothering them,"
Peaks said, and then, noticing that there was still a gun in Cruz's face, said,
"I don't think we need that."
He put a hand on the gun barrel and pushed it away.
"Listen to me, Professor Darby. It is unarguable that you altered your calculations so as to mislead the search team. No one else could have done it."
Shade's face was carefully blank. Cruz took her cue from Shade and stared at the air.
"Anyone might have hacked our network. It's not my fault if your security is inadequate."
After the initial shock, Martin had accessed his inner professor and was now bristling with offended dignity. From the rest of the house came shouts of "clear" as SWAT members moved from room to room on the ground floor and upstairs. The search for The Rock would begin in minutes, and with experienced searchers, it wouldn't take long.
"Oh, man," Shade said in a long, unhappy exhalation. "I am so sorry, Dad. So, so, so very sorry."
Peaks ignored her. Cruz did not. Her eyes went wide.
Leave him alone. It wasn't my father who changed the numbers.
Shade said in an abashed but not exactly humble tone.
It was me.
Peek's head jerked. His eyes widened in amazement because now he was seeing Shade change. Change. Changed. All in a matter of seconds.
He started to yell, but Shade was no longer there. She raced into the kitchen, yanked a 12-inch chef's knife from the block, zoomed through the front door and out to the street, slashed like a crazed killer, and returned, vibrating to a stop.
The sight of her caused a nearly comic recoil from everyone, including Martin.
Listen, I'm sorry. She had to drawl at what to her was a comically slow speed, but still she suspected she was hard to understand.
But I just cut the tires on all your vehicles.
You what? Peek sputtered. He reached for his phone, fumbled, frowned, and slowly realized Shade was holding it.
Here, on me,
Peeks roared, and instantly came the rushing tramp of feet. Two more SWAT members came pelting down the stairs, their weapons leveled, and then their weapons were no longer in their hands, and Shade had both guns slung over her shoulder. It really was absurdly easy. She could have done far more, far worse.
Power.
Shoot her, take her out,
Peeks yelled, and more SWAT members converged, all yelling, down, 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 at Martin and Cruz, trying to get a clear shot, and Martin yelling, no! But again, Shade was no longer there, and their weapons were no longer in their hands, but lay in a heap on the parlor couch.
That's not going to work, Mr. Peeks, Shade said, coming to a stop.
Martin was staring at his daughter, dumbfounded, staring at a version of his daughter, at least. To a father's eyes, she would have been at least somewhat recognizable, but he must have had doubts.
Sorry, Dad, Shade said. Cruz, go to the car.
Shade knew this was a moment of truth for Cruz. Cruz had just achieved at least some of what she had hoped for, maybe, and now Shade would have them on the run from the United States government, no less. Shade had plenty of time to contemplate the fact that she would have to admit to Malik that he was right. At least, somewhat right. But maybe not all the way right, because right now, if Peeks or his gunmen made a move against her father, she could stop them. She was the power here, not Gaia, not Peeks, she corrected herself. It could all end, might well end, in prison bars or gunfire. Shade knew.
Cruz knew that too.
The emotions played across Cruz's face in slow motion. It was suddenly becoming shatteringly clear to Cruz that her life was no longer her own. She was with Shade, bound to her, unable to escape the results of what they had done. She was a criminal, just as much as Shade. And Shade could see the realization dawn on her friend's face, the fear, the excitement, and the resentment that Shade expected would grow over time.
They could put her in prison, in a box, treat her like...
No time for regrets, no time for guilt, Shade told herself sternly. That was all just emotion, feeling. What mattered now, right now, was winning this confrontation. Later she'd find a way to...
To what, Shade?
To what?
Undo the damage?
How are you going to do that, Shade Darby?
Cruz, Shade said, with steely insistence.
Out of sync. Not really sure if it was taking Cruz forever to move, or if that was just the way the world was when you were hyper-accelerated.
Go!
Cruz spun on her heel and ran for the car. It was a madhouse on Hinman Avenue, flashing lights and rushing cops, all staring and pointing at the slashed tires of their vehicles, all with guns drawn now. Half a dozen of them spotted Cruz, leveled weapons, and shouted, "Freeze! Freeze!" Cruz froze, and then the guns and the eyes behind them wavered, perplexed. Cruz had become invisible. Good girl, Shade thought. Cruz ran on, around the side of the house, slipping on wet leaves and tumbled into the minivan's passenger seat. Shade was already there, waiting.
Oh my God, Shade! Oh my God!
Shade made a buzzing sound, then carefully slowed her speech and said, "What
took you so long.
Shade drove, not as Shade, but as this new creature, this sleek plasticine avatar of Shade, with her creepy insectoid legs bent awkwardly sideways to fit beneath the wheel. The minivan speedometer passed 60 before they'd blown past Starbucks. It hit 80 within a block, 90, then 100 miles an hour, with the Subaru careening through traffic that looked to Shade as if it had come to a stop. It was all scarier for Cruz, who saw cars weaving and heard the horns blowing and noted the occasional one-finger salute being raised by outraged commuters. "It will be okay," Shade lied in slow motion. Right side of the road, left side of the road, the sidewalk, Shade sent the Subaru screaming west down Dempster. Cruz took a dream-slow look in the rearview mirror and in a syrupy slow-mo voice said, "No cops!" But it was not the police that Shade felt watching her, following her. Eyeless eyes and soundless laughter, enjoyment, malice, dark and greedy obsession. The things she had dismissed as paranoia were back. Far away, and yet right here, right inside my skull. "Text Malik," Shade said. And now both her voice and the car were slowing down. She was demorphing, becoming fully human. She could not bear that vile, insinuating scrutiny for long. "What do I say? Text him to meet us at the mall. Tell him to hurry and bring tools and wire." "Tools and wire? They'll put out a bolo for us," Shade said. "A what? Be on the lookout, bolo? We need a different car." Cruz did not look happy. Shade turned her gaze away. Later she could deal with what she'd done to Cruz. Later she could deal with what she'd done to her father. The Westfield Mall was just a few miles to their north, and they drove there, carefully obeying the speed limits, and at last, trembling, pulled into a parking spot. "Jesus, Shade," Cruz said. She sounded awed, and not in a good way. But Shade did not want to talk. Not now. Not yet. The dark watchers were gone, but the memory of them persisted. It was a dirty feeling, a feeling of being used, like she'd just found a peeping Tom watching her undress. It was too intimate, that strange attention, too sure of itself. Malik pulled up in his little BMW two-seater. They rolled windows down and talked across the few feet separating them. "What is it?" Malik asked.
"All hell just broke loose," Cruz said.
"Which kind of hell?" Malik asked, as calmly as if he were asking their favorite type of pie. "The FBI kicking in the doors kind of hell," Shade said tersely.
"Gee, Shade," Malik said. "I don't think your clever plan is working out real well."
"You going to snark or help, Malik?" Shade snapped. Malik cursed under his breath and pulled his car into an open spot. He climbed in behind Cruz and said, "We need something no one will notice, something common. Cruz, find something on YouTube on hot wiring cars." The simple act of finding the right vehicle proved ridiculously hard to do because the YouTube video explained that new cars were a whole lot harder to hot wire. So they narrowed the search to old cars, the Subaru prowling up and down the aisles.
"Wait a minute," Malik said, snapping his fingers. "We don't need to hot wire. Not with your ability, Shade."
They saw a Mercedes SUV just pulling into a spot.
"Excuse me," Shade said, and began the swift transformation, swifter, easier each time, and then was gone in a blast of wind, and a door slammed way too hard.
Cruz and Malik caught a brief glimpse of her as she raced up behind the woman driver, who was extricating a toddler from a car seat. Shade dipped into the woman's purse and took her keychain in less time than it took the woman to blink. Malik hopped into the driver's seat.
"I got this. Switch the plates."
The Mercedes plates came off and were swapped for the plates of an Acura three rows over. Cruz got in the back. Shade climbed awkwardly into the front passenger seat, in the middle of resuming her normal appearance, and they drove off.
"We just stole a car," Cruz said. Her normally olive face was unnaturally white, tinged with green.
"The least of our problems," Shade said.
"Yeah," Malik said. "This will go really well when I explain to some cop that it wasn't the fault of the young black male. It's the fault of the white girl. She's the car thief, officer. Why are you pointing a gun at me?"
Oh my God, where do we go?
Cruz wondered.
Malik said, I have a place we can go, at least for as long as it takes the cops to connect me to all this. My cousin has a place.
Shade leaned forward and put a hand on his shoulder.
Sorry, Malik.
Right, he said. Pop the SIM card out of your phone, Cruz, Shade instructed, as she did the same.
Throw it out of the window.
The rock, Cruz said. We left the rock.
Nah, Shade said, and produced the object from her bag. I had plenty of time to grab it.
Chapter 10, Turning White to Red. He was having the most lovely dreams. Armo lay in a drug-induced dream state. He was, despite being in a dream, aware that he was bound at wrists and ankles and lying on a steel gurney. He was aware in that vague, amused sort of way that the drugs allowed, that he was a prisoner, that he was being used, that he was surrounded by machines with bright LED lights and various people in white smocks with masks over their mouths. It was an odd thing about Armo. Ever since he was very young, he'd had the ability to lucid dream. A former girlfriend had been the first to explain that this wasn't normal, and so he had looked it up. And sure enough, most people lucid dreamed only on rare occasions. It seemed that back in ancient times it was more common, and part of what made some people think they had the gift of prophecy. But Armo was pretty sure this dream wasn't the sort of thing prophets saw, because this dream was, to put it bluntly, the sexiest dream he'd ever had. Armo was a D-plus student, but he was not an idiot. He knew the dream wasn't his, that it was coming from elsewhere. In the dream, there was a Yoda-like figure. Not in the sense of being a small green troll, but rather someone meant to seem wise, someone you definitely wanted to obey. And that person, and the person who sometimes stroked his face as he dreamed, were almost certainly the same person, the same woman, the woman in green with a heavy brass ring with raised letters around a red stone, the woman with the steely southern accent. The dream version of the person kept whispering that if he obeyed her in all things, he would have all his heart's desires. It was she, the dream woman, who sent him out to battle demons and trolls and mutants, all to save gorgeous women and be rewarded with the most astonishing sexual favors. This, the dream woman said, this is your future when you obey me. You will be a hero, a warrior, and you will have many, many women when you obey. It certainly sounded good to Armo's hallucinating consciousness. I'll accept one part. That whole obey thing. Even lucid dreaming Armo didn't like that word. It was instinctive, automatic. Since childhood, when Armo heard the word obey, or a phrase like, just do what you're told, these things happened. His lips would thin into a horizontal line that curled just slightly up on the right side. His jaw muscles would flex and his nostrils flare. He would fill his lungs, his heart would slow, and there would come slight, almost unnoticeable movements of shoulders and hands, a shifting of weight, and his gaze would narrow to a tunnel. Like the school counselor and two psychologists had said, oppositional defiant disorder. Armo knew the term, and he had never disputed it. Armo didn't see himself as a bad person, not even a rude or unkind person. He didn't use his size to beat people up or bully anyone. He loved dogs and anything with fur. He was, in his own estimation, a decent dude. He just didn't like doing what he was told. In fact, any time Armo did something bad, it was almost always because someone had ordered him not to. Of course, none of the physical manifestations of Armo's disorder occurred at this moment because Armo was drugged out of his mind and practically paralyzed. And yet the woman, the real-world woman, evidently sensed something off about him. He could tell. From a million miles away, Armo heard her say, Doctor, are you sure the conditioning is effective? Armo did not hear the answer, just the unease in the woman's voice. Yeah, dream lady. You feel it, don't you? He slept for a while then, probably a long while. Deep, deep sleep, and this time with no dreams, lucid or otherwise. When he woke again, he was alone on a cot. He blinked. He took silent inventory. Hands, legs, shoulders, all seemed to be working. Eyes left, a steel wall. Eyes right, a small cell with a desk bolted to the floor, and a steel toilet and sink combo thing. Am I in jail? He sat up and had to fight the urge to throw up as a wave of drug after-effect nausea passed through him, followed swiftly by a crashing headache. He now saw that he was naked, and he felt a bit chilly, not to mention a bit exposed. He sat there a while, blinking uncomprehendingly at a transparent wall, at what appeared to be a single sheet of obviously very thick glass. He had the impression of large open spaces beyond, but it was gloomily lit, and the glass distorted everything. Had to be a distortion, because otherwise he was looking out at a sort of prison or zoo with murky figures in similar cells. And that couldn't possibly be real, could it? There was an itch on the back of his neck. He reached to scratch it, and his fingers touched something small, cool, and metallic. The flesh around it was puffy and swollen, tender to the touch. Despite the headache, despite the nausea, despite his utter bewilderment at his location or condition, where he was, why he was there, what was going on, he was sure the cold object on the back of his neck was some type of control device. His mouth pressed into a flat line, slightly curled up on the right, his nose flared, and then there she was again, the woman. The one who stroked his face when she thought he was unconscious and called him her perfect warrior. She tapped a keypad beside his cell door, and he heard her speak in the voice of the woman from the dream. "Good morning, Armo. I'm Colonel DeMarco. I am your direct superior. From this point forward, you will obey me and follow my orders to the letter." "Cold in here," he said. "It won't be for long." A slight smile there, a confident, even cocky smirk. "There's ODD and then there's stupid." Armo tried not to be stupid, so he said, "Yes, ma'am," and looked down for a moment, signaling submission and concealing from her the defiance in his eyes. "Good. Now, we're going to do a small experiment. You will feel some, what do they say, discomfort, but through it all, you will obey the sound of my voice." There was a second person, a man, standing a little back, his face hard to see through the thick glass, and farther back still, ghostly figures in white lab coats. "Yes, ma'am," he said. The dream-slash-real woman smiled and said, "Let's go with Colonel, shall we? Say, yes, Colonel." Armo thought, "You are piling up trouble for yourself, lady." But he said, "Yes, Colonel." Colonel DeMarco said over her shoulder, "Proceed." And half a second later, Armo's head exploded. The pain was staggering, literally staggering, and he dropped to his knees and tried to claw at the device on his neck, but his fingers had gone strange and clumsy. Pain off. He gasped, sucked air. The pain was gone, but still echoed through him. But something else was happening, something very, very odd. He held his hand in front of his face. It was his hand, but bigger, with short, stubby fingers now ending in wickedly curved claws that, even as he watched, seemed to change from something brown and biological to something artificial and metallic. Impossible. He watched, transfixed, horrified, trying to tell himself it was all just some kind of weird nightmare. But if it was a dream, it was very convincing. As convincing as the translucent white hairs that suddenly sprouted from the back of his hands and ran like a tsunami up his arms. "The polar bear DNA infusion is working," DeMarco said excitedly. "Control mutation. I told you it could be done." "But to what end?" the barely visible male asked, sounding skeptical and a bit defensive. "He has impressive claws and musculature, but does he have any powers?" The kind of powers we can use effectively and control?
We shall see, DeMarco said, sounding smug to Armo. Though he was rather distracted by the changes in his body, the claws, the muscles, perhaps a slight increase in height, and a definite increase in weight. They're doing this to me. It was no longer cold in his cell. He glanced at the toilet on the wall. There was a thin coat of ice on the water in the bowl, and steam came with each exhalation, and yet he did not feel cold. DeMarco's distorted voice came through the speaker. Now we'll go in to see what you can do. He rumbled an answer. The rumble surprised him, like a dangerous purr down deep in his throat. Armo, you will raise your left hand. A pause, a long pause, and up went his right hand, claws and fur and all. Then he lowered it. No, your left hand, the other one. Armo slowly raised his right hand. No, DeMarco snapped. The other hand, your left hand, Jesus, is he dyslexic? Armo lowered his hand and stuck out one foot. Balance was hard, but he had extraordinarily strong muscles in his legs and maintained the pose for several seconds. There appears to be a problem with his conditioning, the male voice said nervously. Just, it's his first morphin. He'll get it. Armo, listen to me. Armo's lips were somewhat hampered by teeth that were far larger than he was used to, so he could not press his lips into a line, and his eyesight was blurrier than usual, but he could still flare his nostrils and begin the minute adjustments that prepared his body, well, this body, for action. You will sit on the cot. That is an order and you must obey me. She held up her hand, pressed the red-stoned ring close to the glass, and he felt a strange yearning to listen, to do what she wanted him to do, because if he did, he'd be a hero, and he'd have many women, and be loved, and admired, and no longer be Aristotle Adamo who calls himself Armo. Do it! That yearning to obey, to get his reward, was strong, but it was nothing next to his instinctive, compulsive, irrational need to say, no! It came out as a strangled, half-coherent roar, and Armo the Defiant was suddenly filled with more blind rage than he had ever known before. He hurled himself at the glass. Wham! Again. Wham! Again. Wham! And then, whatever slight self-control Armo had was swept away on a torrent of madness. Rage filled him. He could feel it. He could feel the adrenaline. He could feel an animal fury that took control of him. Armo became almost a bystander, as if watching from a distance as the body that was not quite his went completely, utterly berserk. For a full 3 minutes, Armo ripped and tore and pummeled everything around him. He shredded the cot. He beat the toilet and sink away from the wall, water spraying in a jet. He lifted the twisted steel toilet and bashed it against the glass again and again and again, with a violence unlike anything he'd ever imagined, wilder than anything from the DeMarco-induced dreams. DeMarco backed away from the glass, her face a snarl to match his own. But she was small and weak, and he was power and violence made flesh. He was insanity. He was all the manic fury in the world, distilled down into one white-furred, two-legged, canine-teeth-bearing, roaring, mindless engine of destruction. The control device, still in his neck, stabbed him deep, like needles in his brain, but the pain was just gasoline sprayed on an open flame. He reached clumsy paws around, dug one great claw into his own flesh, and with a beastly roar ripped the module out and threw the bloody thing at the glass. Gas! Gas! DeMarco's voice cried. Armo heard the hiss of the gas and even in some distant way knew what it was. But the beast he'd become was all out of dams to give. He raged and hammered and roared, but slowly, slowly, he weakened, limbs growing heavy, already dim eyesight dimming further. But by then, his fur was no longer white, but red with his own blood. His blood smeared the walls and the glass, which was cracked and starred, though unbroken. I'll kill you! I'll kill you! I'll kill! He weakened, settled onto his rear end, felt a very different gaze on him,
watchers without eyes, laughers without mouths, many and one, and somehow both far away and right here. His last roar was for them, for those silent voices. And I'll kill you too!
ASO 5. The Okeanos Explorer had begun its life as a U.S. Navy surveillance ship by the name of Capable. It was now a National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration research vessel, 224 feet long, 43 feet wide, with a complement of 46 crew, officers, and scientists. It was overly full at the moment because, in addition to the crew and the scientists, a detail of 6 contractors had been added for security. These were ex-Delta and ex-Marines, whose job was to keep an eye on the crew and the scientists as they retrieved ASO-5, the Mother Rock. The Okeanos also had one supernumerary with no assigned duties, the chief engineer's 15-year-old son, Vincent Vu. Vincent was third-generation Vietnamese-American, born in San Jose, California, raised by both parents in a stable, kind, pleasant home. Vincent was a good student. Vincent was a good big brother to his 2 little sisters. But Vincent had been trouble since he hit puberty, and his teachers and later his family recognized that something had gone wrong with him. The doctor said it was bipolar disorder. They were correct, but their diagnosis had been incomplete because Vincent had not told them everything. He had not told them, for instance, about the voices. The voices had warned him not to divulge their presence, because then the doctors would say that Vincent was schizophrenic. Vincent had access to Wikipedia and WebMD and all the rest, so he knew what schizophrenia meant. Bipolar was a serious stuff, a major mood disorder. Schizophrenia, well, that was to bipolar disorder what pancreatic cancer was to high blood pressure. Orders of magnitude worse. Or better. The voices suggested. Without us, the voices whispered, you'd never even know that your mother was only a hologram. And you might not know that you are destined for greatness, that you are not a normal human, that you are born of the pit, that your true name is Abaddon. He had Googled that name, Abaddon. It seemed he was one of Satan's angels, said to sit upon a throne of maggots. The doctors had meds for his bipolar disorder, which Vincent hated taking because they left him feeling logy, droopy, fuzzy. And frankly, he enjoyed the manic periods and had no desire to give them up. It was during the manias that he set out with a camera bag over his shoulder and obsessively photographed shapes and juxtapositions, unfinished high-rise construction, crushed vehicles at a junkyard, abandoned factories, outdated computers, anything that was hard angles and devoid of humans. Unfortunately, Vincent didn't always avoid human subjects. A camera traced back to Vincent had been found in the girls' locker room at school, and Vincent had been expelled. As was so often the case, Vincent's timing was bad. His father was a career diplomat on a mission to Hanoi. His mother was a chief engineer on the Okeanos, and had been told the ship would be setting out immediately on a secret mission. No one thought Vincent's only surviving grandmother could handle him. The Okeanos had been in such a hurry that its chief engineer, Vincent's mother, had to join the ship by helicopter when it was already 20 miles out to sea. Janet Vu, having no other choice, had brought Vincent along, thinking that maybe a sea voyage would do him good, clear his mind. It wasn't exactly normal to bring family members, but still, the unexpected arrival of the slight young man with the overly focused gaze and the odd habit of laughing at jokes no one else heard would have excited no great concern had this been an ordinary scientific mission. But Vincent, and only Vincent, had not been screened by security. Still, what could be done? The ship needed Janet Vu, and she came with Vincent. Anyway, in his more normal periods, Vincent was a smart, curious, pleasant kid. He was a little guy, so thin you could hardly see him in profile. And within a couple of days at sea, no one really noticed him rushing around with his cameras,
clicking away at coils of rope and masts and the big radar golf ball above and behind the bridge. He was especially fascinated by the deep-sea submersibles and the mantis-like crane and the very large lead-lined shipping container, the mysterious box, that had been chained to the deck just behind the main mast. The box was interesting to Vincent only in that no one aboard was supposed to know its purpose. Naturally, within hours of sailing, everyone knew the box's purpose, or at least its purported purpose. Vincent knew from the schizophrenic voices in his head that it was all a lie, and that the box was there to contain mermaids, who were to be captured and taken to SeaWorld. ASO-5 came down in the Pacific, hundreds of miles from shore. It created a terrific splash and rocked the Okeanos on the ripples. The ROVs, remotely operated vehicles, aided by powerful underwater search radars on a Navy anti-submarine ship, tracked its long, long tumble to the ocean floor, and even as the dust cloud was settling, they located the mother rock. Getting it aboard was a whole different problem involving both of the ROVs, a steel mesh net, and, as it rose to tolerable depths, divers with underwater drills and cables. The rock was carefully, slowly, painstakingly brought aboard, straining the crane, smashing one man's foot, and finally shut into the box. The hinged top was locked down with six high-strength padlocks, and the access door was secured by a combination lock known to no one but the captain and the chief of the security detail, and Vincent Vu, who had unobtrusively shot video of the captain tapping in the combination. Meanwhile, in Scotland, Sean Macbeth, 4 years old, was hungry, and he was teething. Sean had a method of dealing with the teething. He sucked on a chip of ASO2. It was not soft and gummy like his binky, which, in any event, he'd dropped behind the sofa, or his favorite board book, which he chewed more often than he read, but it was still strangely satisfying. When your gums ached and itched, it was nice to have something hard to bite down on. Sean's hunger was a consequence of his big sister, Delia, having been caught up in some texting drama involving Mary and Dougal and Yang. Mary liked Dougal, but Dougal liked Fiona, and even though everyone knew Fiona was only toying with him, Yang was such a nice boy, but maybe too immature for Mary. Anyway, Delia had forgotten her mother's careful instructions about feeding Sean, and now Sean was hungry, teething, and oops, he had just pooped himself, which was satisfying at first, but began to irritate Sean after a while. Sean got angry. He got very angry. His face turned red. Tears started from his eyes. He drew a deep breath and let loose with a screech that could wake the dead, but that did not distract his sister from her texting. Having literally no idea where food came from, except that the kitchen was involved, Sean got angrier and angrier. And then Sean began to change. His pudgy pink body grew larger, as large as the family's retired sheepdog, Gromit, who watched, puzzled, barked once, and ran for the door. Sean grew larger and longer, especially longer, 20 feet long, 20 feet long and consisting of a series of translucent green segments. Tiny triangular feet sprouted from beneath the segments, half a dozen at first, then more as he needed to bear the weight of the middle of his long green body. And Sean's face was no longer at all what it had been. His head looked like a misshapen red apple. His eyes were blank green pupils and yellow ovals. And from the top of his head grew two fuzzy purple antennae. Sean, 4 years old, was a very hungry caterpillar. A 20-foot long green and red, very hungry caterpillar, with no mouth. But then a mouth appeared, a terrifying hole rimmed with needle-sharp teeth. Sean tried to move, but his legs were not very useful, so his legs changed, becoming more insect-like, propagating in pairs the length of his brightly colored caterpillar body. Now he could move. Now he could slither into the kitchen. It was a homey, pleasant, rustic kitchen with a small stove and ancient refrigerator. Food, Sean had observed, came from the refrigerator. but lacking hands, he couldn't open the door. So Sean bit into the refrigerator, his needle teeth chewing right through the aluminum to reach the tasty goodies within, though it seemed the aluminum was also perfectly edible, despite making an awful noise as it was chewed. As he ate the refrigerator and the cabinets, Sean the caterpillar grew larger still. 22 feet. 25. He was so long that part of him extended into the hallway, where Delia saw it, tore the earbuds from her ears, and screamed. She screamed, and having no other way out, climbed out her first floor window and went running down the road toward the village of Portnahavn. Portnahavn was a fishing village built around a tiny inlet where fishing boats lay in the mud at low tide. Delia ran screaming past whitewashed stone and stucco homes, past the modest church, and burst through the door of Antag Shanshi, a tiny pub where her mother worked the afternoon shift, and to the amusement of a handful of afternoon drinkers, shouted, "There's a monster caterpillar eating our house!" Sean, for his part, found that no amount of eating seemed to quell his hunger. In fact, his hunger was now out of control. It filled his entire toddler's brain. Something dark and far, far away was watching him, and, Sean was sure, smiled, though the dark thing had no mouth. "Eat," the dark thing whispered soundlessly. "Eat." Sean ate. Chapter 11. A Really Bad Commute. Quick action by Aaron allowed them to grab a taxi from LaGuardia to JFK and grab two seats on Virgin America to Seattle. The thinking, if that panicky, jittery, shell-shocked state of mind after the annihilation of the plane at LaGuardia could be called thinking, was simply to put miles between themselves and the scene of the crime. 3,000 miles on the first available flight. "It will take the cops a while to identify us," Justin thought. "Hopefully long enough." They stayed overnight at Aaron's sister's home.